the question is that if we just deal with the basic survival needs of refugees, but we don't deal very effectively with things like schooling and health, then we deal with a situation when we have to rebuild the new Syria. You have a generation of children who have skipped out on very essential human capital.
This is Sibios, your source for public affairs research. A podcast from the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota.
In this episode, we are talking with Professor Raghi Assad of the Humphrey School of Public Affairs. Professor Assad researches labor policy and labor market analysis in developing countries with a focus on the Middle East and North Africa. We will be talking about his new research project that is studying the effects of the Syrian refugee crisis on youth vulnerability in Jordan. The research looks at how Syrian refugees are faring as well as the impact on Jordanian youth. At the time of this recording, the Trump administration, the day before, ordered a missile strike in retaliation of a chemical attack on the Syrian population. This will undoubtedly increase the Syrian refugee crisis. Welcome, Professor Assad.
Thank you.
Thanks, Raghi. I'm wondering if you could spend just a couple of minutes talking about your background and the context of this research.
So I've been working for the past 30 years on issues of employment and education and gender in the context of Middle East labor markets, really looking at the social underpinnings of unrest and youth frustration and the anger that led to the Arab Spring, for example, but have never really directly looked at conflict and the implications of conflict and the consequences of conflict in the region. And part of the reason is that conflict countries have always been difficult countries to work in and dangerous. And the kind of research I do requires cooperation with the government and statistical agencies and large-scale data collection. And that has never been feasible in a conflict setting. But it's hard to avoid conflict in the region. And really, if you want to deal with the big questions, you have to look at what's going on in terms of the reasons and the consequences of conflict. And so Jordan is a very good, interesting context to look at that because it's a highly affected country by conflict. It has been an island of stability in the middle of conflicts in Syria and Iraq and elsewhere, and Palestine, for example. But it's very much affected by those refugee flows and the other results of conflict. But it's been a country that it's possible to do work, to do research in. So I took this opportunity this time to actually go and organize a research project on the impact of refugee Syrian refugee crisis on Jordan.
Can you talk a little bit about how the Syrian refugee influx has actually affected Jordanian youth?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of misconceptions about the impact of conflict on native populations. And that's one aspect of the research. Of course, the other aspect is exactly how the refugee population itself is affected. But on the effect on Jordanians, first of all, the refugee flows are extremely large relative to the size of the Jordanian population. So let me put that in context. There are about 1.3 million Syrians, plus another approximately recent arrivals among Palestinians who lived in Syria, another 300,000, 400,000. So we're talking a minimum 1.5 million refugees in a country that has a population of 6.5 million. So to put that in the U.S. context, it's as if you had 50 million people flowing across U.S. borders in a very short period of time. While countries like Turkey are also highly affected, Turkey is a much larger country with 80 million people. Lebanon is like Jordan, a very small country with very large flows of refugees. Now, interestingly, that despite that, we find that, for example, the unemployment rate of Jordanian youth is not strongly affected because unemployment is a phenomenon that affects educated Jordanian looking for formal jobs, and that's not the job market that the Syrians are in. The Syrians are mostly at the low end of the job market looking for very informal jobs, poorly paid. So what you find is that it's the Jordanians who are less educated, maybe a little older, who are working in these informal job markets whose wages are being affected downward. but not so much the young Jordanians who are mostly educated. In fact, many of them are seeking employment in the Gulf. So one has to be just careful about the way in which you analyze these things, because people make assumptions that, of course, unemployment rates will go up. Well, we haven't seen that they have gone up. Now, interestingly, the group that seems to be most affected by the influx of Syrians into Jordan are because it was before the conflict started, Jordan was importing a lot of Egyptian workers kind of to do the low-paid, informal, dirty jobs, the jobs that the Jordanians themselves didn't want to do. And those are the ones who are in direct competition with the Syrians right now. And in fact, many of them are being pushed back into Egypt because of that competition.
So it's the Egyptians that are actually in competition.
That's right. It's the low-wage Egyptian workers who have been, in fact, the Jordanian market is very, very, very open for these flows of low-income migrants from Egypt, and they're the ones who are now in direct competition with the Syrians. But if you actually look at the data, the people who are by far the most affected are the Syrians themselves. They're the ones who have extremely high unemployment rates, very low rates of work in general. Schooling rates among children have plummeted. The age of marriage among young women has really gone down, where you have teen marriage is now common. Childbearing has increased dramatically among teens. And so it's the Syrians who are really kind of taking the brunt of the effect.
Destabilization of the whole societal infrastructure.
Absolutely. I mean, right now, the services and institutions and everything that supports kind of regular development in society has collapsed. So, of course, the international community has come in to try to replace a modicum of that in the form of refugee camps and services provided by international NGOs and international organizations. But it's really not meeting the entire demand for the need for services in these areas.
When we look at the objectives of your research, how do you imagine your research affecting the reality on the ground?
Primarily, we are trying to inform the institutions or organizations that are trying to respond to that crisis. So we're collecting data as well as informing then the organizations like the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the United Nations, UNICEF, the Children's Fund, there is a Jordanian government coordination body that coordinates all the aid that is provided for the refugees. The Jordanian government that is worrying about absorbing the refugee children in schools, about providing housing, providing water and sanitation and other services. So those ministries are clearly an important target of our work. But very importantly, we're also working directly in our data collection with the statistical offices of Jordan, people who are kind of tasked with collecting data on what's happening in Jordan. And so we're working with them as well in how to improve their data collection practices so they can deal with this new phenomenon for them. They're used to collect data on Jordanians, so this is quite a new issue of trying to have such a large fraction of their population being non-Jordanian.
So I can imagine that setting up the framework for this research study was very complex in and of itself.
Yeah, I think what's fortunate is that we are building on work that we had been doing in Jordan for some time. So in 2010, I organized a large data collection effort, something called the Jordan Labor Market Panel Survey, which was a big survey of Jordanian labor market conditions in cooperation with the Statistical Office of Jordan. So that gave us a baseline right before the refugee crisis, which started in 2011, 2012. And so that was very fortunate. We had very detailed data on what was going on in Jordan at that time. And we designed the work so that we could actually go back and revisit the same individuals and households that we interviewed in 2010. And we're talking about 5,000 households, approximately 25,000 individuals. And so when we went back to talk to the Jordanian government about doing the second wave of that survey, we said, yes, but there are people, of course, who have come to Jordan who are not represented in that original sample. And so what do we do to try and capture that new group? So we agreed with them to select what's called a refresher sample. And a refresher sample is kind of a new sample that's added where we oversample areas that have been highly affected by the refugee inflow. So we got data on the percentage of non-Jordanian household heads at the neighborhood level all over Jordan, and then oversampled areas that had a very high fraction of non-Jordanians so that we can represent this new population that has flowed in.
Tell us a little bit about who else is collaborating with you on this research. I mean, how is this actually working?
Yes. Well, so the research has this kind of important quantitative component based on these household surveys. It also has a qualitative component where there are people who are going to interview in depth refugees as well as service providers and ministry officials, etc., so that you complement, you kind of get the why, the answer to many of the questions. I'm working primarily through an organization called the Economic Research Forum, which is based in Cairo, Egypt, and covers the entire Middle East and North Africa, including all the Arab countries, Iran and Turkey. And this has been my base of work in the region for the past 25 years or so. So I have a very ongoing working relationship. I'm on the board of trustees. I head their thematic area in labor and human development. So it's where I do my work in the Middle East through that organization. That organization provides a very good platform, but then you have to bring in other collaborators. So I have collaborators from here in Minnesota, University of St. Catherine, a former PhD student of mine who's a professor there. I have a collaborator from the American University of Beirut, who is going to be primarily the demographer and sociologist who's going to help us do the qualitative field work. I have collaborators from the University of Southampton who are also close collaborators of mine who have worked on similar issues in the region. And then in Jordan itself, our partners are the Department of Statistics, as well as we have a small Jordanian consulting firm that is going to help us do the data collection.
And how did you obtain the funding for this research?
Research like that, it's a two-way thing. You have donors who are interested in funding research like that and sometimes approach you and say, we're funding work on youth and we know of your work. Are you interested in putting a proposal together? And of course, so we sometimes also approach them and saying, we realize that you have this program on youth issues. We would like to extend our work to this new setting. So we got funding from the Ford Foundation primarily to do this work, and it's primarily through individual connections I've had with the people who are in the Cairo office of the Ford Foundation. But we also then later, our collaborators in the University of Southampton were able to put in a proposal for something called the British Academy for the Social Sciences and the Humanities, which is a kind of a government funding source for social science research in the UK. And so we got a significant amount of funding through that as well.
So you've talked a little bit about the logistics and the framework, how you obtained the funding. Can you share a little bit about what personally motivated you to even begin this project?
Well, a lot of the work that we've been doing on youth and labor markets has focused on the plight of educated young people in finding formal jobs that fits their educational qualification. That has generally been work that looked at a fairly privileged group, people who have gained an education and who are trying to become middle class by getting middle class jobs, and but are being frustrated in their quest for doing that. But then we didn't focus that much on the very vulnerable groups, the people at the bottom of the pyramid who really can be very strongly affected by external shocks like wars and refugee crises and conflict. And so this is really what drove this research, is this about youth vulnerability. So about the people whose prospects are most likely to be affected as a result of a refugee crisis or a war or a conflict. And therefore, looking at young teen mothers, for example, looking at young people who are unable to get an education because of conflict disrupting their educational, and then what's going to happen to them over time. Looking at men who are unable to make a living and support or a livelihood to support their families and what happens to them. And so that's really the greatest motivation here, is to kind of really focus on the outcomes for that most vulnerable group.
I I'm wondering, I know that this is still ongoing, but are there some early findings that you're learning about that you can share with us?
Yes. I mean, some of the purpose of the research is also to question assumptions and misconceptions. And so some of the interviews we've been having with service providers in the region, I had one of my PhD students who was just in Jordan a couple of weeks ago, and one of them is still in Jordan working on interviews, is, for instance, the issue of gender and gender and services and how that interacts. And often what is assumed when you work in the gender area, it means you work with women and girls. When in fact, it turns out that the other side of the gender coin, the young men, are the ones often having a very hard time. And so a lot of that money going for gender services are going to women and girls. But in fact, the boys' schools are the ones really suffering because of course, they have a population that has much harder behavioral problems. They are much more likely to drop out, to go to try to work, to find jobs. They have issues of concentration in the middle of a kind of a high-stress situation. And so the boys' school are underperforming by far the girls' school, and the boys are underperforming the girls often. But nobody wants to kind of divert funds to focus on boys because they're assumed to be the privileged group in that sort of dyadic. So that's part of one of the misconceptions that is being found. The same thing with kind of a lot of what's happening to the young women, in fact, results from the kind of vulnerability of their fathers, for example. So if you have a father who's unable to protect his family, unable to get a livelihood for them, in fact, they tend to fall back on trying to do more conservative norms by, for instance, marrying their girls off early so that they are less vulnerable to sexual predation, et cetera, et cetera. And so a lot of the issues that have to do with what's happening to young women originate in what's happening on the male side. So gender really has two sides of a coin, and both of them have to be looked at. So that's one area in the findings. Another area is where the findings we talked about earlier about what sort of labor market outcomes are affected and who's affected within the Jordanian society. And so, for example, we're looking at employment for young people. And as I said, there's not a lot of competition among most Jordanian young people and the Syrians that are coming in. But the people who are in competition may be older, maybe people who are may already be retired early from their jobs and trying to find employment in the informal economy, and now not able to find it because there is a lot of competition among by Syrians trying to find those jobs. So those are some of the initial findings, but we're also looking at impacts on housing and housing markets. We're looking at impact on the education system and whether absorbing large number of Syrian kids in Jordanian classrooms is affecting the quality of education in those schools. But we don't have results yet on those areas.
We don't know where this is going to go. We could be now witnessing an escalation of the Syrian crisis. And down the road, what we all hope for is for hostilities to diminish, stability to be experienced. What is your research going to do to be able to create a blueprint to help affect the transition to normalization?
I think it's really a big question. So right now, of course, a settlement in Syria seems so far away, and it looks like we're going to have to deal with large numbers of refugees in countries like Jordan and Lebanon and Turkey for a long time. You know, when Europe panics about 1 million refugees at the level of all of Europe, you can imagine when you have 4 or 5 million refugees in the three countries on Earth. So the question is that if we just deal with the basic survival needs of refugees, food, water, sanitation, shelter, but we don't deal very effectively with things like schooling and health, which have long-term consequences for the lifetime of these refugees, especially the children, then we deal with a situation that 10 years from now or 5 years from now, when we have to rebuild the new Syria, you have a generation of children who have skipped out on very essential human capital. And those children are going to be a problem for Syrian society for a very long time to come. It's not going to be easy to kind of go back and give them the human capital they missed out on. it's a bit like the effect of the Cultural Revolution in China, where a whole generation of people skipped out on very important education that had long-term consequences for that generation over time. And we're going to see that. So this is, in fact, the generation that will be supposedly rebuilding Syria, and they're going to have huge deficiencies in their human capital and preparation. So that's why it's very important at this stage to get the international community to respond so that we don't have these huge deficiencies, so that the education needs, the health needs, and the fact that you have young women marrying in their teens and having many, many more children over their lifetime, and that large fertility boom in some sense will affect Syrian, the service requirements in Syria for a lifetime. And so it is very important to mobilize resources now so that to make it possible for Syria to rebuild effectively, even if it's 10 years from now.
Can you bring this together for us? The typical American who is watching the news and seeing these horrible events unfold in Syria, it may evoke empathy, sympathy, helplessness, but yet it's important. Can you talk a little bit about why it's important for the typical American to understand the Syrian refugee crisis and the impact it's having on not just one country, but many of the countries?
Yeah, I mean, of course, there is the first dimension is the humanitarian dimension of this, is that these are real people and that are suffering tremendously from a breakdown of their country and basically being pushed into abject deprivation out of no fault of their own. Now, when this was happening after the Second World War in Europe, people were very sympathetic because this was a group of people that most Americans felt close to. They're Europeans like us, or they're of European origin like us. But I think the world now is so integrated that problems are not limited to one part of the world anymore. If this part of the world is going to have problems, it's going to spill over on Europe and the U.S. for a long time to come. And so it's really important to try to intervene. And I'm sorry that it took this long for the international community, but the international response is very inadequate right now from a humanitarian point of view. Then the second issue is to raise the cost of this conflict in terms of the continuation of this conflict, in terms of future stability of that region and how important that region is and has been to U.S. national security. So there is a national security dimension of having continued failed states in this part of the world, which will create continued pressure on national security in the U.S. for a long time to come. Now, and the third issue is simply an issue of that those refugees don't stay in place. There's going to be a lot of pressure, whether they cross from Turkey or they cross the Mediterranean. If situation is really bad, they're going to land on European shores and eventually on U.S. shores, and often with the dire consequences. And so I think there's a lot of reasons why Americans should worry about this, not the least of which that we are now in a much more integrated global society where we cannot just say this is their problem and we're here and they're there and we shouldn't worry about it.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Civios, an initiative of the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. To learn more about this segment, please visit civios.umn.edu.